You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
I bet it's brand new information to people that President Obama had a six-month ban on the Iraqi refugee program after two Iraqis came here to this country, were radicalized, and they were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green massacre. Well, most people don't know that because it didn't get covered.
What could be the reason for this conspiracy of silence by the mainstream media? My guests Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards will be here to discuss the atrocity which occurred in Kellyanne Conway's head in 2011 and the day's other big stories, including a terrorist attack which did happen in Paris this morning, President Trump's plans to do for Wall Street what he has already done for America's airports, and a gathering boycott of the Trump family's business interests. Might the presidency prove less profitable than he anticipated? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's executive editor Steve Bloomfield and Monocle 24's executive producer Tom Edwards. Welcome both, and we will start in Paris this morning, the location of what appears to have been a mercifully ineffectual terrorist attack. A man armed with a machete charged four soldiers patrolling the Carousel du Louvre shopping centre near the museum of the same name, injuring one before the soldiers opened fire, wounding the assailant. Two rucksacks carried by the attacker did not contain explosives. Steve, first of all, very early days with this one, obviously, but it does raise again the eternal question, I think, of all of these attacks perpetrated by a lone actor is, where is the overlap between desperate, ruthless, ideologically motivated terrorist and possibly none too bright, deranged stoner who's read things in the newspapers and some wires have come loose?
There is overlap, but the other thing is, in many senses, it doesn't really matter if, you know, the people that are carrying out attacks like these are, as you say, you know, they have dangerous masterminds behind them who have created, helped to sort of create this attack, or whether they are just people who have read things on the internet and then try and do something themselves, doesn't really matter, depending on the damage that they actually cause. The important thing, I think, to remember here with what's happening in France is that France is still under a state of emergency. Yeah, it has been since,
indeed, so.
You know, for more than a year. And with elections coming up in April, where at the moment the candidate leading the polls for the first round anyway is Marine Le Pen of the Front National, this will, you know, this will have an impact. This will be part of the discussion over the next coming days. The question is whether French citizens feel that, well, this is, you know, to use that horrible phrase, the new normal and we just deal with it and it's okay, or whether it leads to more discussions about further crackdowns.
Tom, how should a government in the position that France is in react to an attack which, and one doesn't wish to belittle the injuries to the soldier who was injured or the fear that must have been struck into people in the vicinity when they heard shots fired by a popular Parisian tourist attraction. But this, in the scheme of things, was not a huge incident. How should a government respond?
Well, I was slightly surprised that the Prime Minister, for example, quite early on did describe this as an attack of terrorist motivation. I slightly take issue with what Steve says, because I think, you know, if you talk about terror, then, you know, citizens need to be terrorized in a way for it to be effective. And I think that most French people looking at this would see, you know, okay, a lone wolf attack, call it what you want, dealt with effectively with relatively little damage other than to the aggressor and to this unfortunate soldier. Well-armed soldiers in the right place at the right time. Presumably they're part of this increased...
I think that's more saying in terms of the motive. Whether it doesn't matter whether it was well planned by a group or whether it is an individual who is inspired in some way, what matters is the damage that he does. And in this case, as you say, the damage is minimal, so perhaps not so much of a, it won't have as much of an impact.
Steve, President Donald Trump did find the time to sound off about this this morning in amongst picking fights with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Iran. What do you make of his reaction versus his, how to put it, somewhat more muted, by which I mean non-existent, response to the massacre at the mosque in Quebec on Sunday?
What he said was stupid. You know, if you are a commentator, if you are a celebrity on Twitter, you can say what you want. When you're the president of the United States, to say, you know, talk about the attacker as a new radical Islamic terrorist, when we don't know for sure, France on edge again, get smart, US. That, you know, he's not a commentator anymore. He's the president of the most powerful nation in the world. And that sort of behaviour is incredibly unhelpful. The other thing as well to remember here is that, you know, France is still technically an ally of America.
Well, for the moment.
Yes. And
we've got week three to look forward to.
Yeah, and but that's the thing. You know, this is yet another Western ally that Donald Trump, the president of the US, will have annoyed, frustrated, insulted, embarrassed in some way in his first 15 days. That is not smart behaviour.
Okay, well, let's move along slightly, because there could be no better illustration of the times in which we appear to be living than the fact that an actual terror attack, and that is the one at the Louvre this morning, has been crowded out of global headlines by one which never occurred. Bowling Green, the Kentucky town hitherto best known for building Chevrolet Corvettes and being mentioned in an Everly Brothers song, also one by John Prine, now that I think of it, Grandpa was a carpenter, has been named by President Trump's imaginative counselor Kellyanne Conway as the site of a terrorist massacre perpetrated by Iraqi refugees in 2011. There is, however, as has been widely pointed out, a difficulty with deploying this atrocity to justify a harder line on asylum seekers, which is obviously that it never actually happened. Tom, are we buying her claim that she misspoke and meant to refer to, as she has since claimed, Bowling Green terrorists? And they did exist, in fairness. Two men were arrested in Bowling Green, later convicted and now serving life over plotting to send money to Al-Qaeda?
In short, no. I think it's probably perfectly contrived. I don't think they make mistakes. I think they're happy to peddle this kind of untruth. And the thing that really strikes me about this is, for how much longer will it even engender a reaction of surprise, whether that's amongst the sort of knowing, I don't know, metropolitan liberal elite or whatever, who point out the errors. And more broadly, and this is where I do worry, if, you know, the inner cabal of Trump can peddle untruths on such a brazen, of such a brazen nature and on such a scale this early and this consistently, you know, you can't help but worry where this goes. And, you know, frankly, the appetite potentially to constantly be picking these things up after week, I mean, you were joking about week three, but what about week 10 or week 50 or week 100 if we ever get that far? You know, I wonder if it diminishes. Now, you could argue that the fact that it's so brazen, it will encourage, I don't know, responsible media agencies and so on to be bolder with taking them to task and holding them to account. But I do worry which way it could go. In the end, people may just tire of dealing with it and try and shut out the white noise. And this could become, you know, the normal standard of communication, if not from him, from his acolytes.
Steve, all that being the case, does the media, especially the live broadcast media in America, which has enormous influence, have to start thinking seriously about whether it can continue to put Trump spokespeople and surrogates on live-to-air broadcast? Because, you know, we know this ourselves from doing live broadcasting. We don't do an awful lot of confrontational stuff here, but there is still that thing when you're talking to somebody live and they say something that strikes you a bit of, hang on, I'm not sure about that, but you can't always check in the middle of an interview. If you're inviting Kellyanne Conway onto Fox or MSNBC or CNN or whatever, do you now need to put her on a 10-minute delay?
No, I don't think so at all. I think you still invite her on. You just have to be prepared to challenge people if you think they are going to be pushing a certain line in the way that you would have be ready to challenge anyone. And I think actually, you know, this sort of amateurishness, really, because I think it is. I don't think it's deliberate. I think this is actually it's amateurish. Is going to be a problem for the Trump administration, because what we're already beginning to see is mainstream news organisations like, for example, CNN, that are very vanilla, middle of the road, uncontroversial, neither left nor right. Hey, we just give you the news, and tend to involve lots of talking heads.
They have grown some teeth, haven't they?
Are starting to say, actually, let's look at this statement that was made today. Here are the facts. You'll see things like, you know, when Kellyanne Conway talked about alternative facts, when Sean Spicer talked about the number of people at the inauguration. These things broke through into normal everyday American life. There was a basketball game where they put up the
Dallas Stars, yeah.
The day's attendance at 1.5 million. You know, these things start to break through. And I think, you know, this is the perfect story to be on an evening news broadcast. You know, wherever you are in America tonight, I'm fairly sure this will be covered, and it'll be about how, you know, Kellyanne Conway, Trump spokeswoman, has made up a massacre, because it is an amusing story with a serious side to it. It's perfect for TV. There's footage of her saying it. You know, it will be everywhere. These sorts of things will start to break through. So I don't think it's and to be honest as well, I think we're going to get to a stage where they get better at putting across their line.
I just wonder, you know, is this the best sort of thing? Is this the most effective way to deal with them? You say that, Steve, you know, if at a big sporting event, which again, traditionally it's very much, you know, fly the flag literally and, you know, sing the anthem, if we can make these kind of tongue-in-cheek jokes of that order, and let's be fair, it's a pretty decent gag, that's maybe more effective at dealing with this sort of error and with the general the rhetoric that we see from Trump, from Conway and others.
Well, the Bowling Green massacre has become the subject of an inevitable social media pylon, quite a lot of which has been extremely funny. And it did make me wonder, I don't myself necessarily subscribe to the idea of Donald Trump as any kind of proto-fascist demagogue. I don't think what he's doing is coherent or organised enough to qualify as such. But having travelled a fair bit in places which are run by fascist demagogues, the thing that always strikes me, and I'll put this to you, Steve, is the one thing they have in common is their utter humourlessness. They fear nothing more than laughter and ridicule. They understand that the moment people start laughing at you, you are done. Is Trump vulnerable in the same way?
No, because the people are laughing are people who didn't vote for him. And the people that did vote for him know that the other side are laughing, and they don't like that. And I can understand why. I think, you know, the biggest problem Trump is going to have in the coming months is the issue of competency. You know, there will be people who voted for him who, you know, are hardline supporters or support him, whatever more. There will be people who voted for him because they wanted him to shake things up a little bit. But within that group, I think there are going to be a lot of people that will look at, okay, well, he said he was going to repeal and replace Obamacare, but actually it seems a little bit chaotic what they're trying to do, and they, you know, it seems like we're going to lose some of our healthcare. They might say, well, look, you know, he said he was going to do this on the economy, but actually, you know, there are issues over competency here. I think that's going to be the biggest problem. People don't like incompetent governments. They fear them more than overbearing governments often.
Tom, do you think, though, that notwithstanding, we will see repeated in his presidency what we saw in the campaign, which was that so many reporters trying to understand Trump supporters and what their motivations were kept pointing out the man's, you know, fairly obvious defects, that he's a blusterer, that he's an oaf, that he's unqualified, that he's ill-mannered, discourteous, misogynist, etc., etc., etc. And the consistent reply was, we know, we don't care.
Well, yeah, I think that's a problem. But I think what Steve says is interesting. And, you know, you do wonder that, you know, you look ahead and you wonder, is there a single instance of incompetence so grave that even some of those may turn waverers, and then that could be a problem for him if it's within his core demographic. But I think Steve's right, actually. It probably is more likely to be a slow burn proof of lack of fitness, and that will come from I think the things that he said he would address that he frankly couldn't. We talked before about if you go to the Rust Belt or if you go to a town in Pennsylvania where the mines closed down, you know, it is not going to take long for it to dawn on those quite committed Trump supporters that their lot isn't getting any better. And in fact, as I think Steve just said about Obamacare, for example, it may be getting quite a lot worse before it gets better. And I think that's probably more damaging. It'll be a slow, toxic build-up of suspicion about his ability to push forward, frankly, any agenda.
The scary thing, I guess, and a final thought from you on this, Steve, is when that moment comes, whether people will blame Donald Trump or somebody else.
Yes. I mean, look, any leader who deals in fear will always try and find someone else to blame. And, you know, it's either shadowy elites or foreigners or a combination of the two often. But I think, you know, as I say again, I think that issue of competence will become an issue. The other thing as well that, you know, those of us who disagree with Mr. Trump need to remember is that it takes a lot for anyone to change their mind, to change their views.
It really does.
And, you know, it would take me, you know, it would take a lot for me to change the views of things that I've thought for a very long time. It's going to be the same for Trump supporters. You shouldn't just expect them to go, oh, well, you know, this whole idea of, oh, the scales will fall from their eyes. They'll see that they were wrong. It's like, no, come on. Look, it's, you know, it takes a long time for you to come to the conclusion that, you know, what you believed might not have been right, or what you hoped would happen hasn't quite turned out. And I think those that oppose Mr. Trump have to be thinking about, how do you try to appeal to those who are trusting in him, are hoping in him, but might end up being disappointed? How do you peel those supporters away?
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. And coming up next, President Trump's next big idea.
Visit our online shop, where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or, if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York, or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we will take care of you personally. See you around.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards and Steve Bloomfield. Now, at some point today, President Donald Trump is expected to focus his glare upon financial services regulations, especially the Dodd-Frank Act introduced after the 2008 financial crisis, with a view to preventing the total collapse of the global banking system, regression to barter economy, outbreaks of cannibalism, and so forth. Trump has previously vowed to repeal Dodd-Frank, and if we have learnt anything from the past fortnight, it is that he intends to keep his promises. So, is he about to do for banking regulation what he's already done for international diplomacy? Tom, what could possibly go wrong?
I mean, this is, it's a complex question about regulation. We know that Trump's committed broadly to a quite a hands-off approach. I think, again, it would be interesting to go back to that pro-Trump voter that we sort of mentioned before and asked them what they thought, because obviously he voiced his skepticism during the campaign at some stages about, you know, the influence of Wall Street broadly on Hillary and how these people were sort of controlling things and this sort of thing. And yet he's vowing to, you know, significantly roll back, you know, a piece of legislation which, let's remember, all of this structure, which was to try and essentially protect consumers. I mean, that is what this was for. Now, it may have its weaknesses, but it's, you know, what kind of message does that send to bring a sledgehammer to this? But again, we know he's not worried about that. He'll say that, you know, less is more in terms of control and that it will secure a better deal. And I'm not sure, frankly, that, again, a pro-Trump or the Trump voter will, you know, understand enough of the nuances to probably on this issue, the Dodd-Frank thing, to feel particularly exercised one way or the other.
Steve, do people not grasp that it was a lack of regulation and lack of oversight which brought 2008 about in the first place?
Yes, people do. I think voters do. And I think politicians like Donald Trump do. But, you know, Mr. Trump obviously also feels that, you know, as he said today, he wants to cut a lot out of Dodd-Frank because friends of mine that have nice businesses, they can't borrow.
And so I don't think we need to work hard at spotting the key phrase there.
No, indeed. There is an issue here, which is that, you know, the crash that happened in 2008 devastated the global economy. There was very little that was done to correct the faults in the economy. But one thing that was done was the introduction of the Dodd-Frank Act in the US, which helped to bring about a bit more regulation and a little bit more of a firewall between certain types of banks. You know, they had these famous stress tests, which Timothy Geithner, the then Treasury Secretary, introduced, which strengthened up some of the American banks. We're still seeing, for example, European banks being fined by the Department of Justice. RBS, the British bank, is one of the most recent ones to face those fines over their failings in 2008. And, you know, to give Donald Trump some credit, during the election, you know, he fired up his base by talking about the big problems on Wall Street, with you know, that he said was in the pocket of Hillary Clinton, or Hillary Clinton was in the pocket of Wall Street rather, and you know, how he was going to go to Washington and drain the swamp, and he talked about Goldman Sachs and how dangerous they were, and that was a big part of his appeal.
He did get rid of a lot of those big Goldman Sachs guys because he hired them.
Yes, they are no longer at Goldman Sachs anymore. They're in his cabinet. So I think this is going to be tricky for him if the Democrats play this right, because, you know, he's essentially saying, "Oh, forget everything I said then. I'm going to do this instead." And it'll be interesting to see whether Democrats can galvanize enough public opinion to say, "Hey, look. You know, look at what Donald Trump, the candidate, said. Now look at what Donald Trump, the president, is doing."
Okay, well, pursuing the theme a little bit of extending President Trump some credit, I do want to look at an aspect of his first 14 days in office which do encourage some optimism about the next 1,447, which is that they've prompted an extraordinary upsurge in civic engagement, not just in the US but around the world. Part of that has been some pressure on Trump's commercial interests, or at least on his family's commercial interests. The Nordstrom chain has now dumped Ivanka Trump's fashion products due to poor sales. Other retailers being pressured to follow suit. And we've seen Uber CEO Travis Kalanick quit the president's business advisory council following criticism of his role. Tom, is this, one, entirely fair? And two, is it effective?
I'm not sure on either count. I mean, I can see the logic. It's interesting, if you look at the justification from some of these businesses, they're keen to stress that actually many of these decisions are based on what they describe as commercial constraints or commercial considerations, which is vague enough to still be essentially an admission that indeed it is a response to public pressure.
Because those commercial considerations have been caused by political motivations, well, i.e. people have stopped buying this stuff because they don't like the president.
And the process isn't that joined up. I mean, it is interesting. I do wonder about the, what would you call it, the efficacy or the efficiency of targeting, for example, you know, a line of clothing in a department store. If you're trying to make a broader point about your dissatisfaction with Trump's administration or his approach or his policies, it seems maybe like an easy win and an easy headline. I'm not sure it will make that much difference.
The issue with Uber is actually quite interesting because, you know, obviously Travis Kalanick has, you know, decided that being aligned with Trump isn't necessarily good for him. Not because it's not good for business, but because it's not good with his staff. Because so many Uber employees, and I don't like the word employees, but, you know, Uber drivers, and they are employees, are migrants or are the sons or daughters of migrants. And that he's had this enormous backlash from the people that his company relies on, who are obviously incredibly upset with the immigration ban. And again, that's another interesting aspect of what's been happening over the past few days, is that a lot of big companies in America that, you know, are trying to get on well with the White House are now faced with issues like the immigration ban from these seven nations, where they have to work out how much they're going to try to play nice with the White House and how much they're going to stand up for what's right for their business.
Well, that is a story which is doubtless not going anywhere and which we will come back to. But finally tonight, we are now joined in the studio by Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, to talk about what's going on with the magazine, because we recently published our 100th issue, which I believe is on a newsstand near people now. But we're now, well, logically enough, at work at on the 101st. It would be surprising if we'd sort of skipped ahead to the 107th. But the 101st will be significant.
Well, of course, when people think, oh, 100, they wonder what you can do about your 100th. And they may have wondered why we were a little bit muted about. We were happy to get to 100. But 101, of course, is actually the anniversary issue. It's exactly 10 years of the magazine. And we're taking it as an opportunity to do a bit of a refresh. We've brought in the decorators and we've kind of had a look around. And we've decided that actually, over time, a few of the areas need a bit of a touch up, and we're going to build a couple of extensions on the back. There's going to be no.
Got rid of the asbestos.
Yeah. Well, he or she left quite a while ago. We're not going to.
You're talking about there, is it?
We're not going to quite dig the super basement, but we've gone through everything and felt, you know, that in the nature of our reporting, that we've reached a kind of bit of maturity that we want to take another step up and we want to grow in our ambition. We feel that our readers have expanded and changed across 10 years, and we want to make sure that we're reflecting the things that they care about and are passionate now. And we want to make sure that we are continuing in print to make people excited. And of course, you need to have some gradual change, but this is the first time in 10 years. A redesign is a strange word because it makes you feel that you're giving up on something you've got, and we're not. It's an expansion. It is a refresh.
What can we say for sure about what people can look forward to in issue 101?
Well, we have an A to E range of numbers that run through the magazine, everything from affairs to edits. We're adding a new section. We're adding a dedicated fashion section to divide fashion and design. Design will become very much more a place for architecture and more high-end, you know, talking to great designers and architects. We're adding an eye section at the back, which is going to be on a special paper, an inventory section, which is going to be all about everything you need to do in the month ahead. We have an expanded coverage of food and drink, but also at the front of the book, in the topics we're talking about today, just upping our game in the kinds of reporting we've done. And sometimes almost going back to the very early days where we were able to give stories much longer runs. We've changed some things at the front, so we have a space. I'm not going to give away the stories at this point, but we have a great piece by our Hong Kong bureau chief who's been out on the road for 10 days on a Southeast Asia story, which I think delivers on all the things we want to promise. I think we've always been a good voice, but I think we're going to be a very strong voice again after this.
And when do we have an actual publication date for this yet?
Yeah, so it's the March issue, which comes out, I think, in like February the 23rd.
Plenty to look forward to there then at the end of this month. Thank you all for joining us, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. That is all we have time for on today's episode. I was trying to do a portmanteau of issue and episode there. It's not going to work. It isn't going to catch on, that one. Today's show, I think we'll stay with show, was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elisa Mayer. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.